Chapter 5. Bringer of Sorrow. Refugees. Requisition. Zephon's hands betrayed him, as they betrayed him every day. The metal fingers lifted from the hair strings of the antique harp, their shuddering subsiding as he ceased focusing on them. Zephon was familiar with the science behind this malfunction, having memorized the reports on the various failures of biology-stroke-technology linkage taking place where his stumped arms met his bionic limbs at both elbows. The pathways of nerve and muscle were poor at conducting the information from his brain. A common enough failure of fusion surgery when dealing with crude implants grafted to the human form, but to his knowledge he was one of the only living space marines to suffer such complete augmetic rejection. That was why he was here, of course. He knew it, even if his brothers had been too compassionate to call it exile. You couldn't fight in a legion, let alone lead a strike force, if you couldn't pull a trigger or wield a blade. And so he had come, willingly to all outward perception, to Terra. He'd accepted his exile, pretending it was an accolade as part of the Crusader host. He stood with the other representatives of each Space Marine Legion, garrisoned on the throne world and charged to speak for their brothers. In hoc officio gloriam, read the words on the preceptory's basalt declaration plaques, there is honour in this duty. A dubious honour at best, Zephon knew, especially now that the throne world no longer trusted the 18 legions. He was one of only two blood angels present in the 30-strong monastic ambassadorship that the Crusader host represented. Of the other warriors, even his legion brother Marcus, he saw no sign. He had retreated from the hollow duties of the preceptory, content no more to work through the unreliable lists of the dead and record their names. With the galaxy burning, no reports reaching Terra were anything close to reliable. Of his legion and Primarch, there was no word at all. Was he to painstakingly etch the name of every single blood angel into the bronze funeral slabs in the halls of the fallen? Madness. Worse than madness. Futility. Sanguinius lived. The legion lived. So he had retreated to his personal chambers, where other work awaited him. It was a truth, known to relatively few souls, that many of the most beautiful works of art in the entire Imperium, indeed in the span of human history, were displayed only in the bowels of Blood Angels' warships and frontier fortresses, stained glass windows that would never see the flare of true sunlight, statues of metaphorical gods and demigods at war with creatures of legend and myth, paintings wrought with forgotten and rediscovered techniques, rendered in agonizing detail, going unseen amid orchestral compositions of instruments that would never be played for human ears. The warriors of the Ninth Legion didn't strive in the same way as the soldier artisans of the Third. The Emperor's children sculpted, painted, composed to achieve perfection. They grafted great works to bring about something superior to anything shaped by lesser hands. In the act of creation, they exalted themselves above others. This external, proud focus was anathema to Zephon and many of his brothers. The creation of art in song, in prose, in stone, was to reflect on the nature of humanity, a step forwards in understanding the distance between mankind and their legion-evolved guardians. Like all of the legions, the Blood Angels were born and shaped for battle, with roles of honour a match for any other, with valour beyond question. But away from the eyes of their cousin legions, they celebrated a culture of enlightenment, a quest not merely to understand the nature of man, but to understand their distance from the root species they were destined to fight and die for. Zephon, a tribal boy who had eaten dust in the starvation seasons and slaughtered mutants with packs of his kindred before his 12th summer of life, had learned to play the harp. For a century he'd excelled, his gift for harmony a match for his talents on the field of war, until a single battle had stolen both of his gifts. All hope was swept away by the alien sword that had severed both of his arms, mutilated both of his legs, and cut him down in indignity. After the 9th bionic surgery, the Legion's apothecaries had bade him face the unwelcome reality. The grafts had taken as well as they would take. His physiology was simply not suited to the process of augmentation. He still practiced his music, jangling out discordant melodies with his shaking, slipping metal fingers, just as he still trained with his bolt gun, able now to fire 1 in 5 times when he tried to pull the trigger. That was a significant improvement. His aim was similarly ruined. Though his new arms had the strength of his old limbs, even their micro-trembles threw off the razor precision of his former marksmanship. His blade work suffered just as savagely. All of his precise balance and easy footwork was lost in the random tenses and spasms of his reconstructed leg joints. Hence his exile. Hence this assignment to Terra. In hoc officio gloriam, there is honour in this duty. How those words made him smile. His hands rested on the fine strings once more, their twitching just beginning again, when the door klaxon gave its monotone whine. Zephon froze, instinct pulling his eyes to where his weapons were racked against the wall. He'd had no visitors in well over a year, since his last meeting with the Sigillite, when Malkador had refused yet another of the Blood Angel's requests to be granted command of a small frigate and set out in search of his legion. The 30th such request. Zephon rose from the seat, laid the harp aside and moved across the Spartan chamber to turn the door's wheel lock. His left leg whirred with smooth mechanics where his thigh and knee had once been, the four-taloned claw that had replaced his right foot clanking down upon the floor. When the door swung open on hinges badly in need of oiling, Zephon was faced with the towering figure of a custodian, a 4-meter-tall guardian spear clutched at the warrior's side. The immense suit of armour hummed, the eye lenses of his conical helmet blazed. "I seek the bringer of sorrow," the custodian said. Out of his armour and clad only in a black tunic, the Blood Angel felt curiously at odds with the warrior in full battle plate.
"You have found him?"
"You are far from my expectation," the custodian admitted.
He disengaged the seals at his collar and removed the helm, revealing an ageless face with Urhan ritual scarring, like rivulets of saliva running in 5 lines down his chin and throat.
"I am Diocletian. Are you truly the bringer of sorrow?"
The title stabbed at Zephon harder the second time. He wasn't sure why.
"That was my title when I led men into war," he replied. "You sound disappointed."
"That's because I am. I expected a champion in exile, and I find a bionic cripple. However, my disappointment is irrelevant. Activate your arming servitors and make ready for battle."
Zephon hated the palpable sense of hope that surged through him with those words. The shame of it burned him.
"I assume you are aware that the Sigillite has forbidden any of the Crusader host from acting without his seal of authority?"
"I will spare you a lesson in where the Sigillite's authority begins and ends regarding the Custodian Guard and the actions we may undertake. In this instance, he was the one to commend you to our service. Now arm yourself at once, bringer of sorrow."
With reluctance, the Blood Angel lifted his hands, showing his arms composed entirely of metal struts, plating and muscle cabling from the elbows down. His treacherous fingers twitched as if on cue. Diocletian looked for several seconds. He blinked once.
"Is there some significance in your mutilation that I'm supposed to acknowledge?"
Zephon lowered his hands.
"I cannot fire my bolter. My hands do not obey me."
"Can you at least hold a sword?"
Zephon wondered if he was being mocked, though he couldn't guess to what purpose.
"Not reliably," he admitted. "Your invalidity is noted. Now activate your arming servitors. Once you are ready, you'll come with me."
"To where?"
"First, to the Sabarakan isolation compound via the Orphiuchus colonnades. Then to the halls of Unity Memoria. I do not understand. Why?
Understanding will dawn in time. Let obedience come first.
Diocletian gave another of his long, emotionless stares, marred by only a single blink.
How, Zephon wondered, could these golden avatars ever be considered more human than us?
Custodian,
he asked.
I'm waiting for you, Diocletian replied. My patience isn't infinite, bringer of sorrow.
Zephon moved to the wallcom, keying in the code to summon his armory thralls.
Given the circumstances, Zephon is fine, thank you.
If you prefer. I agree that the title is unbearably theatrical, especially for a cripple.
Zephon felt the first stirrings of anger, and by the blood of Sanguinius, it was a welcome thing indeed.
You are the first custodian I have ever spoken to, he said. Are all of your kind so direct?
Are all of your kind so intoxicated with self-pity?
Diocletian looked almost as if he might smile, but the expression was stillborn.
Now be swift, please. You aren't the only lost soul I need to reclaim today.
Lost soul?
I told you we are bound for the Sabarakan isolation compound.
The Blood Angel narrowed his pale eyes. Sabarakan was home to traitors who had marched beneath the War Master's banner.
Perhaps I am missing some aspect of humour in your words, Custodian?
There is never any humour in my words. Now come with me. You and I are going to free some prisoners.
Together they stalked through the Imperial Palace. Diocletian was displeased by all he saw. He and Zephon walked side by side through the bustling hallways, scattering pilgrims and refugees before them. Helmed, the two warriors had the option of immunizing themselves against the sweaty salt stink of unwashed skin and unclean breath. Diocletian grunted in disgust as he sealed his vox grill, relying on his armor's internal air supply. The processional halls of the Ophiuchus colonnades were choked with the homeless detritus of war, coughing and sniffing and muttering, in some cases weeping. He felt their eyes upon him. Their judging eyes, doubtless wondering why Diocletian and his brethren hadn't saved them all and won the Galactic War already. He felt their ignorance as a weight on his shoulders. That, at least, was a response that edged upon nobility. Far less honourable was his irritation at the moronic animal weakness in their helpless gazes. Why were they here? Why were they not still among the stars, fighting for their homeworlds?
"Something ails you?" asked Zephon.
"This detritus," Diocletian replied.
He regretted his honesty at once, for the Space Marine gave a dismissive grunt, and the custodian felt himself suddenly at risk of being drawn into a conversation.
"This detritus is what we fight for," said Zephon.
The Blood Angel gestured with his gauntleted hand, forcing a snarl of armour servos. Several of the humans nearby flinched back. Their awe briefly turned to fear.
"These men and women," Zephon continued, "they are what we fight for."
Diocletian snorted, the sound wet and ugly.
"I fight for the Emperor."
"We fight for the Emperor's dream," Zephon replied at once.
"For the Imperium. Semantics. Without the Emperor, his dream could never be realized. He alone can bring it to pass, no other."
"Then we are both right," Zephon replied.
"You are deluded as well as crippled," thought Diocletian.
"It seems to me, Space Marine," he ventured, "that too many of your kind decided they were fighting for the Imperium rather than the Emperor. Perhaps if more of you thought as the 10,000 do, we would not stand where we stand today, preparing for the end of all we know."
Zephon fell blessedly silent. Diocletian took in the great hall, once a place of ranked statues and great wide windows, now a place of huddling scum and cowards who should be issued with las rifles and packed into transport ships back to the front lines. He let his gaze, and the accompanying target locks, drift across the crowds of filthy refugees lining the processional hall's sides. Clusters of them were gathered around servitors carrying pallets of dried rations and dehydrated protein potables. But the Blood Angel's silence was short-lived.
You say we fight for the Emperor, not for his Imperium. The natural question, then, is to wonder, without him, would we still fight? Is there any reason to raise this great empire if he is the only soul capable of leading it? We would be committing ourselves to a futile battle.
You speak of impossibilities, Diocletian chorused, loyally adamant. Mankind must be ruled. It has a ruler. Let that be the end of it.
Yet his flesh crawled at the unfamiliar philosophizing. Without the Emperor, who would rule? What lesser minds would take up the mantle of command in his place? In what thousands of ways would they fail to meet the Emperor's vision? Such thoughts were unwelcome and distracting. He felt slowed by them, felt them running like black poison through his veins. Both warriors snapped to mechanical halts as two figures manifested before them. Diocletian's spear was free in a blur of ruthless precision, leveled down across one of the refugees' throats. Its keen edge sang with a soft metallic chime from cutting the air so swiftly.
Sacred unity!
Zephon hissed the curse across the vox.
What are you doing?
Diocletian looked down into the wide eyes of a young boy, no more than 7 or 8 Terran standard years old. The figure at the youth's side was even more diminutive. A girl, the boy's sister by the uniformity in skin tone and facial structure, a year or two younger. Diocletian had no talent for estimating the ages of unmodified humans. She looked up at the custodian with wide, terrified eyes. A scream sounded from the crowd, the plaintive cry of their mother. Both children's mouths were wide, their lips shaking. Diocletian lifted his blade away from the boy's throat and reactivated his helm's mouth grill to speak aloud.
My apologies, he said with grave formality.
The children flinched at the rawness of his vox-altered tones. Zephon moved slowly, reaching up to remove his own helm. He stood bareheaded before the two children as their mother reached them. The boy, resisting his mother's attempts to herd him, tore free and stood before Diocletian once more.
Are you the Emperor?
Diocletian stood motionless.
Is that a jest?
He asked, making the boy flinch at the tone. Zephon's smile was bittersweet as he looked down upon the boy. He lowered himself slowly, his red warplate grinding loudly through the motion, until he was on one knee before the child. Even then he was still thrice the boy's height.
No, child, the Blood Angel replied. He is not the Emperor, though he knows the Emperor very well.
Tears ran from the edges of the boy's eyes. The immensity of the armored giants before him filled his senses, from the assault of overwhelming red and gold to the thrum of active battleplate. Awe was writ plain across his young features, awe and desperation and an expression of fearful need. Diocletian would have voxed his irritation had Zephon still been wearing his helm to hear it. Zephon was blind and deaf to the custodian's annoyance, or simply chose to ignore it.
What is your name, young one?
Darak.
Darak, the Blood Angel repeated.
My name is Zephon, and as grand as my companion appears, he is not the Emperor.
What is wrong, child? The boy stammered his words.
I want to ask the Emperor when we can go home. My parents are still there. We left them behind. We had to get to the evacuation ships.
Diocletian glanced at the woman protecting the little girl. Not their mother, then. Her facial structure bore the signs of familial resemblance, so there was some genetic linkage. An aunt or older cousin, perhaps. He removed the target lock, playing over her filthy face, dismissing it along with his cursory interest. Zephon wasn't as compelled to move on.
I see, the Blood Angel said. And what world do you call home?
Blaze. We're from Blaze.
Zephon nodded as if he knew the world well. Diocletian doubted that any of the Ninth Legion had ever set foot upon it, useless backwater that it was.
Then you've travelled far, said the Blood Angel.
Welcome to Terra, Darak. You're safe here.
Safe for now, Diocletian added silently.
What are your parents' trades? Zephon asked the boy. If they were fighting, they must be soldiers. The boy nodded.
They were fighting the grey machine men from Mars.
Well, my parents are warriors as well, said Zephon, neglecting to mention that they had died over a century ago on the radiation-choked deserts of Baal's second moon. Their ashes would be nothing more than blight dust on the wasteland winds by now. The boy, Darak, turned his eyes up to Diocletian.
Are your parents soldiers?
No, said Diocletian. They are long dead. My mother was a slave who died of intestinal flux, and my father was a barbarian king executed by the Emperor's own hand for opposing the principles of unity.
What?
They finished speaking with you, Diocletian told the boy.
Darak narrowed his eyes at Diocletian before returning his gaze to Zephon.
I want to go back for my parents. I want to ask the Emperor to send the Space Marines,
he vowed with painful conviction.
The Emperor could send you, couldn't he?
He could, Zephon agreed. And perhaps he will. I will ask him of his plans for Blaze the next time I stand before him. The hope in the boy's eyes made Diocletian's gorge rise. He was all too aware of the many eyes upon them at the heart of this ludicrous exchange.
Our duty awaits, he said, his tone terse.
Indeed, replied Zephon. Now, Darak, I must do my duty to the Emperor. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me. The boy nodded, mute. Zephon replaced his helm. His voice emerged through the harsh, drawling rasp of his vox grill.
Look after your sister, Darak.
Darak moved to his aunt and sister, the latter weeping softly after the scare Diocletian had given her. Diocletian walked on with Zephon at his side. If the refugee herd's stares had been an irritant before, they were practically boring through the custodian's armor now.
You are a creature of pointless sentiment, Diocletian voxed to his new companion.
He heard Zephon's sigh as they walked onwards.
You said I disappointed you, custodian.
I assure you that the feeling is mutual. I had not imagined conversing with one of the 10,000 to be such an exercise in soulless discourse. Diocletian didn't believe that deserved a reply. He hoped Kyria was having better luck with the Fabricator General. Intruder. That was Kane's first thought. Not the intruder's identity, nor how long it must have taken this defiler to reach his inner sanctum. He didn't even consider the severity of any event that would drive an outsider to venture this far into the catacombs. The trespasser's materialization alone occupied his first hostile thought. The audacity of her presence. Intruder. Intruders disrupted the music. They were flawed notes amidst the rhythm of crashing hammers and the breath of the forge flames. And this one was a disruption uglier than most. Zagreus Kane let himself drop from the harmony at the heart of the foundry's song of iron and fire. It was a detachment that took place on three levels, spiritually, physically, cognitively. First, he exloded his conscious focus from the new spheric data clusters that allowed him to oversee the administration and management of several thousand menials at once. The abrupt loss of infinite information was a hole in his soul, as the voice of the great work was sucked into sudden silence. Then he physically removed himself from his command cradle, hauling himself along the overhanging steel beams using his four mechanical arms and luring himself into the waiting tank treads that comprised the lower half of his body. The lancing pressures of connection, reconnection, stabbed dully through his nerve-numbed innards as the metal tendrils of union snaked their way into his augmented guts. The racked Volkite and Graviton weapons snaked their linkage feeds into his back, shoulders and spine. Each one of them powered up, folding close to his tracked thorax or aligning against his hunched back. Lastly, as the armoured tank treads ground their way along the gantry, bringing him on his juddering way closer to the visitor, the intruder, he readied himself for the tedium and inevitable inaccuracies that came with dealing with those unenlightened souls forced to communicate through the impurity of uncanted language. As the foundry hammered and roared and clanked and crashed around him, the overseer came to a shuddering halt before the slender figure of an Oblivion knight. She wore the overlapping gold armour plating of her order over the traditional bronzed male bodysuit, which was to be expected. Her hair was crested into a warrior's topknot, which also ran according to his expectations. Similarly, her portcullised rebreather mask was entirely in keeping with the equipment customarily attributed to the Sisters of Silence. She had marked her face with designs of ink, an imperial aquila tattooed in red upon her forehead, as if her allegiance were in some way not entirely obvious. What he found interesting, however, were the signs of wear and tear upon her war gear. The sensoria cluster, in place of his left eye, flickered a brief hololithic beam across the Oblivion Knight's armour plating, recording signs of unfamiliar damage inflicted upon the various layers. Intriguing. Very much so. She greeted him with a series of hand gestures. He was impressed that she included all 12 of his long-form titles. That was a formality few outside the Martian Mechanicum would know to offer. Zagreus Kane looked down at her. His voice emerged from an augmeter in his neck, shaped from human teeth mounted in a framework of black steel and polished bronze. It gave him a snarling grin in the middle of his throat.
"State the necessity of your intrusion."
She made 3 brief gestures with a single hand.
"I do not consider myself to have changed at all," said the Fabricator General of Sacred Mars.
He adjusted his forged blackened, ash-darkened red hood with one of his 4 hands.
"Change implies the possibility of degeneration. My alterations are evolution, Oblivion Knight. Each one a step towards divinity. Now, I repeat, state the necessity of your intrusion."
She told him her name without saying a word. Her identity was an irrelevancy, but one that Kane let pass. Still, frustration burned. Had they been linked to the new spheric data array, this exchange and every single nuance within it would already be over, rather than lurking at the very beginning of the pleasantries.
"I am overseeing the disposition, deployment, and armament of several million troops and several hundred fleets, Kyria. In addition, Fabricator Locum Trimagia is transponded to me in accordance with the new precepts of Mars. I am aware of all that took place at the Hierarch's Council and the loss of Adnector Primus Mendel. Your expositional formality is a drain on my time."
She replied in hand gestures, none of which were an apology. At last, they were cutting to the matter's core. As her hands moved, Kane's iron-sealed mouth, his true human mouth, trickled oil-lubricated coolant saliva as he wheezed, briefly taking over from the auto-respiratory processes of his cyborged lungs. The gesture made the heavy graviton cannons wired into his spine cycle in a brazen sign of his speculation.
"I understand," he said. "Supply me with the specifics."
Kyria offered a data slate, which Kane took by deploying one of his many secondary multi-segmented abdominal servo arms. 3 thin fingers snatched it from the Oblivion Knight's grip and immediately drew it into the folds of his robe, slotting it into a data inload cavity between his ribs. For the ghost of a second, information danced behind his eyes. And for the first time in many months, Fabricator General Zagreus Kane hesitated.
"This is a significant order of requisition," he stated.
He made no move to return the data slate in the wake of his understatement. In a single requisition demand, she was requesting as much battle iron and war flesh as the Mechanicum had supplied to the great work in the last 2 years alone. Kyria nodded, asking a question with her hands.
"Yes,"
was the reply.
"Ammunition is the easiest to provide, and it will be done. We can also harvest forge workers for the thralls and battle servitors you require. A recall of Cybernetica cohorts will be issued at once from all unthreatened systems within Segmentum Solar, and a clarion call can be raised to attract Myrmidia cultists in nearby systems in order to replace the significant drain you are proposing. But it is of immense import that you understand what you are requesting. This will severely and potentially gravely deplete the Mechanicum's forces on Terra, as well as our involvement in the active spheres of conflict in the Solar War."
Kyria signed her understanding, resolute in her motions. Cain paused, calculating.
The divine armors you request can also be provided, though not in the numbers you require. Those numbers simply do not exist on Terra, and they will be salvaged, or otherwise remastered from war spoil, requiring reconsecration in the Omnissiah's name. Even House Terran has sent its divine armors into the stars to engage the Warmaster and the false Fabricator General.
Kyria signed a reply.
Your acceptance is noted, said Cain. And I return a question of my own. What of the Legio Ignatum forces already deployed to aid in the great work?
Kyria's reply was curt and simple. Cain felt the synthetic fluids in his veins heat briefly in reassuring warmth. The fire wasps yet functioned. Good. Good.
So be it. I shall admit, then, that there are no Legio Titanicus elements remaining upon Terra at this time. As with the Night Households, all are deployed and garrisoned off-world.
Kyria hesitated, then signed her understanding.
Now, said Cain, to the final element in your order of requisition. This is a request of particular magnitude.
The sister's hands moved in a graceful query. Cain mused over his answer. He didn't like the effortless confidence in her eyes. Perhaps ordering Trimagia to raise the issue of Mars's reconquest at the Gathering of Hierarchs had been an error of tact. The Fabricator General retreated into the shadows of his hood, thinking, considering, processing. It could be done. Of course it could be done. And with that hide-bound fool Mendel dead, beautiful new possibilities were suddenly dawning. He turned in his socket, twisting his torso to look back over his shoulder at the seemingly endless production lines in the hellish amber light of dancing forge flames. He would need to retake his place in the Omni-Cradle to oversee the fulfillment of the requisition order, and he would need the genius of his trusted kindred to complete the list's last element. Someone would have to submit to reforging. Someone would need to be reforged on a level so absolute and fundamental that it bordered on rebirth. If Cain agreed to arrange it. If. Such power in such a little word. Swiveling back to face the Oblivion Knight, Cain looked down upon the warrior, amusement shining in his remaining human eye. To outward appearances, it was all that was left of the man he'd been only 5 years before.
No.
Kyria was under no similar compunction to hide her surprise. She signed another query. Cain emitted a crackle of code.
The Mechanicum's ability to comply is not the question, Oblivion Knight. Its willingness is. Am I able to fulfill this last element of requisition? Yes. Am I willing to do so? No.
She was more cautious now, her hands moving slower, her eyes locked to his shadowed features. Cain's spinal-linked weapons deactivated in sympathy with his rising confidence.
Then it is my pleasure to enlighten you, sister. The priesthood of Mars has been instrumental in the Webway's reconstruction. The Omnissiah has shared many of its details with those of us wearing the Holy Red, whom he took into his service within those tunnels. But he is silent now. He has been silent for some time. So much has gone unspoken. You ask a great deal of the Martian Mechanicum, and we give. We provide. We supply. We feed our iron and toil into the Webway. Now the time for answers has come.
Kyria's caution crystallized. Her signed reply was lengthy, her glare laden with accusation.
So we have been told, Cain replied. And none of my priesthood doubts that the Omnissiah's great work will be the salvation of the species. I am not holding the great work to ransom. I am making known my desire for enlightenment.
Kyria said nothing. After a long moment she gave a curt nod. Cain continued, sensing how close he was coming to the truth.
These orders of requisition come from the 10,000 and the Sisterhood of Silence, not the Master of Mankind. Not even from the Sigilite who speaks with the Omnissiah's voice. You desire the final, most vital element on this list for your war. I will grant it, at the price of a single answer.
Another nod. The Oblivion Knight could have been carved from sandstone for all the emotion she showed on her dusky features. Cain leaned down. His tank treads grumbled as they turned him slightly.
The Webway is a resource beyond value. Tactically, logistically. It is recorded in my predecessor's archives that the Omnisire himself spoke of its passages being used to return to Mars. Will this avenue of return be made available to us in the near future?
Cain heard the too human emotion in his vocalization. He didn't care. A momentary weakness was permissible. The answer meant everything. Kyria's reply was both blunt and brief. Unknown. Cain had expected no less, but unknown was not forbidden, and he would take every shred of hope he could salvage from the situation. He'd recorded Kyria's ocular and respiratory response to pore over later, whereupon he would run the dilation of her pupils and the sound of her breathing through myriad filters to determine even the slightest determinant.
Mars must be retaken, he said softly, slowly,
as if hypnotized into sounding human.
The alternatives are unacceptable.
Kyria said nothing, did nothing, merely looked up at him. Cain felt an all too familiar frustration tighten its clutch around his innards. The Sigilite had refused many times to launch a full reclamation of sacred Mars. The seventh Primarch mirrored that refusal. But Cain was no longer a locum, trailing at Kelbor Hal's heels in the dark forges of the Red Planet. He was Fabricator General in his own right, the rightful lord of humanity's twin capital, Mars, and his rank matched theirs in influence and authority. It was time he was respected and heeded in accordance with his position.
The Mechanicum will supply your war on this single condition. The Omnisire himself once spoke of a route within this alien webway that reaches back to sacred Mars. Ad Nector Primus Mendel named it the Eresian Path. No matter the cost, no matter the effort, you will see it reinforced and held, ready for use once the Omnisire's great work is completed. Even if thousands of other routes and passages must fall, you will ensure that the way to Mars remains in Imperial control.
To his surprise, Kyria replied at once, signing a simple affirmation. She signed a question of her own.
Yes,
Cain replied, feeling the prickling creep of suspicion.
That is all I require, for now.
Kyria nodded, signing her thanks.
How easily you give your word,
Cain vocalized, with an emission of crackling background code. Her reply was far longer this time, her hands weaving for several seconds. Cain watched, seeing her assurances, allowing himself to be appeased by them. He did not know whether to believe her, or indeed if her kind could lie at all, but it was of no consequence. The first and most crucial step had been taken. Opportunity had at last presented itself and been firmly seized. That poor, mind-stunted fool Mendel, so proud of his place at the Omnisire's side, now achieving in death far more than he ever had in life.
Then the last element on your list of requisition will be carried out at once, Kyria of the Silent Sisterhood. The Mechanicum will provide you with a general.